From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We're talking neighbors this week, the good and the bad of sharing space with strangers. If you're Latino, moving into an all-white neighborhood can sometimes come with a high price.
Marcelo was killed, attacked and killed by a group of teenagers, seven teenagers, who went around hunting, quote-unquote, beaners, immigrants, for entertainment.
Journalist Mirta Ojito on the story of a neighborhood hate crime and how one city in Kansas has embraced new neighbors.
We have these people here. Are we going to accept them as a blessing, or are we going to consider them a curse?
Plus, making the visit to immigrant detainees a little easier. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In Spanish, neighbor is vecino. But there isn't a translation for neighborliness, to make someone feel welcome. We start our conversation on neighbors with a story about a place where many Latinos don't feel welcome. It's not a neighborhood, it's an entire state. 2 years ago, Alabama passed one of the strictest anti-immigrant laws in the country. If someone without papers is stopped for any reason, a broken taillight, speeding, the police are instructed to arrest that person and alert federal immigration officials immediately. Suddenly, Latino immigrants in Alabama's small towns were hyper-visible and afraid. But one police chief is bucking the system. From Clanton, Alabama, Ashley Cleek has more.
Patricia Hernandez lives in fear of the police. Before she drives to Walmart, she and her little daughter do a ritual.
We cross our chests and we pray, and I tell her to pray to God that we don't run into any problems and that we don't have any problems with the police, because that is what we have the most fear of.
Patricia lives outside of Clanton, a sleepy rural town of 10,000. She doesn't have a driver's license because Alabama doesn't allow undocumented immigrants to apply for one. About 10 years ago, immigrants from Mexico and Central America started arriving here as migrant farm workers. Many stayed. But when House Bill 56 passed 2 years ago,
we saw that people in our community were afraid.
That's Natividad Gonzalez, the leader of a community immigrant women's group. Kids stopped going to school. Parents stopped driving. They registered their homes in neighbors' names. But Natividad didn't go into hiding. Instead, she contacted Brian Stillwell, Clanton's chief of police.
We were kind of portrayed as like a German Gestapo hauling everybody off to jail, which is not how we are or we want to be portrayed. That's not what we're here to do.
Stillwell says he never liked the immigration law.
We can't use any discretion at all to do what we feel would be best for the community and the public.
Instead, the police were mandated to arrest anyone who didn't have a valid visa and contact immigration officials. Sometimes when immigrants were stopped, they'd literally get out of their cars and run. Stillwell says the turning point for him came when they had to arrest a young Latina mother for something like a broken taillight. She had an infant in the car who was still breastfeeding. They were forced to bring the baby to the holding cell.
When you're enforcing the law, it's not always black and white. There is some gray area in there, and this is one of those situations that fell right in between.
Soon after, Stillwell told his officers to stop arresting undocumented immigrants for traffic violations. He says police chiefs across Alabama feel the same way, but are too afraid to speak out. Thank you. Natividad and Patricia cautiously step through a metal detector. Stillwell has invited their group to a meeting on his own turf at the police station.
Again, welcome to the Clanton Police Department. I'm Brian Stillwell. I'm your police chief.
Patricia has questions. Can the police find her car that went missing 3 months ago? And can they please stop the roadblocks where she lives?
Where is your community at?
¿Dónde está ubicada, digamos, su comunidad?
On Jamison.
And this would be where the Hispanic community lives.
Well, Jamison's not my jurisdiction. Okay.
Stillwell can do something about the stolen car, but he can't do anything about the roadblocks in the rest of the county or other issues immigrants raise. Dishonest bail bondsmen, surveillance at Walmart, deportations for minor traffic violations. In fact, Stillwell is the only law enforcement officer in the area who has agreed to meet with them. The county sheriff and other local police chiefs all declined interviews. The only thing the sheriff did say is, if someone does something illegal, they will be arrested. But the feeling in Clanton is different.
Every day I get up, I put this badge on, I put this gun on, and I put my life on the line for everybody.
That's Sergeant Robert Bland. He speaks straight to the crowd.
It doesn't matter what color their skin is, if they're male, they're female, or anything. I put my life on for everybody.
After the meeting, Natividad says she's optimistic.
They really gave us strong signs of trust. I think that's what people from this meeting are going to take back today and share with everybody in the community.
In November, state lawsuits struck down one key part of the law. Police are no longer required to arrest undocumented immigrants at traffic stops. In an email, Stillwell writes, "No more arrests for traffic tickets or equipment violations. We are relieved, as I'm sure the ladies are. This is good news." For Latino USA, I'm Ashley Cleek in Clanton, Alabama.
What happens when you end up in a place where you have no neighbors, where you don't know anybody, and you end up in a detention center? In fact, the largest immigrant detention center in the country is in a small town about 150 miles south of Atlanta in Lumpkin, Georgia. Remote and sparsely populated, it can be hard for friends and family of the detained immigrants to visit them. But 3 years ago, a group of neighbors came together to try to make things a little easier. They opened a hospitality house nearby called El Refugio, or The Refuge. Martha Dalton from WABE in Atlanta has our story.
Hundreds of men under the watchful eyes of their guards walk swiftly to and from the lunchroom at the Stewart Detention Center in straight, orderly lines. They wear different colored jumpsuits according to their level of offense, red for the most serious crimes, orange for those in the middle, and blue for lesser charges like being in the country without papers. Cruz Santibanez has come to visit her brother. He was convicted of voluntary manslaughter and was told he'd be deported.
It's just very difficult. The transition from thinking that he was going to be here with us and just knowing that he's not, it's very hard.
The Santibanez family drove 9 hours to get here. They can't stay the night because Cruz, a college student, has to get back to school. But they've stopped at El Refugio, a mile down the road, to take a break. Cruz says she'll be back.
I'm going to see him again once I graduate. You know, that's going to be my graduation vacation. I'm definitely going to go see him before I start, I guess, seeking the real life.
Stewart Detention Center's remote location is one reason the American Civil Liberties Union of Georgia recommended shutting it down. The problem also caught the attention of Charlotte and Anton Flores.
You know, they're no longer just a story that you hear about, but they're your friends, and so that makes a huge difference.
They're a Mennonite couple who live in an intentional Christian community about an hour away in the small town of LaGrange. They live among immigrants and non-immigrants alike and believe in a life of simplicity. Charlotte says they helped establish El Refugio after learning about the experiences of people in their own community.
And then for us as well as our faith is really a huge motivator. I mean, we believe when it says that we should welcome the stranger, that's what we should do.
That's exactly what El Refugio does. It's staffed entirely by volunteers. Donations keep it afloat. Guests stay for free here in a narrow yellow house with 3 bedrooms and 9 beds. There's just 1 bathroom, but they've never turned anyone away. They continue to welcome strangers, like this family of 11 who traveled a whole day from the coast of South Carolina. Miriam Pinoco and her family come to Stewart to visit her brother, but they arrived too late today. So they'll stay the night and try again the next day.
Estábamos un poco tristes, pero nos dijeron que para mañana podemos visitarlo. Y tuvimos la oportunidad de venir aquí con ustedes y conocerlos, y les damos muchas, muchas gracias.
We are a little sad, she says, but they told us we can visit tomorrow, and we had the opportunity to come here with all of you and get to know you, and we're grateful. The sentiment goes both ways. Marie Friedman Marquardt, who teaches religion at Emory University in Atlanta, helped found El Refugio and now coordinates volunteers. She admits the work can be emotionally draining.
Every time I come, this just sort of heaviness comes down on me as I'm traveling here.
But she says that changes once she gets here.
It's a remarkable experience to meet with a stranger in this place and to build a loving relationship. It's a gift. It's a real gift. So it brings us back.
This weekend, there are students here from Manchester University in Indiana volunteering. Katie Herter is a peace studies major. She says visiting with a detainee personalized the issue of immigration reform for her.
When you look at numbers, it's so hard to, you know, it's easy to dehumanize a person. But when you actually see them and you hear their story, it's harder to be more apathetic. Like, you really have more empathy once you go visit them.
The founders of El Refugio say they'd like to see a day when the house isn't needed anymore, but they don't see that happening anytime soon. So for now, they're doing what they can. One meal, one bed, one place of refuge at a time. For Latino USA, I'm Martha Dalton in Atlanta.
And time now for a bocadito, a little morsel of news. A long-standing musical tradition on college campuses in the United States is a cappella. The groups date back to the early 1900s, but now there's a new kid on the traditional collegiate music scene. This is the music of Mariachi Northwestern, the first all-student mariachi band to come out of Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. At community and state colleges in the Southwest, mariachi isn't new, but now private colleges across the nation are picking it up. At Rice University in Texas, Alberto Rodriguez is part of the newly formed Mariachi Luna Llena. He says the group has been met with enthusiasm.
I think everyone gets excited. I mean, we start playing and the crowd just get, you know, stands up, and some already know, you know, the typical Cielito Lindo or, you know, Amor Eterno.
The group gives Latino students like Rodriguez, who make up 13% of Rice's student body, a way to share their Mexican culture. Now, yes, even Yale University, home to the first a cappella group, the legendary Whiffenpoofs, is in the process of starting a mariachi group. Well, the Ivy League ya no es la misma cosa, gente. Check out performances by some of the groups we mentioned online at latinousa.org. Coming up, murder among neighbors.
Hate crimes against Latinos are not new, but I was shocked to see the number of Latinos who have been killed in recent years and also historically.
Stay with us. No se vayan on Latino USA.
Incógnitas bestiales silban. Honrados pasajeros se sacan el sombrero y adquieren nuevas formas y más. Silencio pide paso, se esquivan los abrazos. Pasiones y discordias luchan. Escucho sintonías, tu estrofa ya no es mía. Rockeros en la sombra dirán.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Americans get new neighbors all the time, and from all over the world. Just ask any Major League Baseball team. The major leagues are far more diverse than, say, the National Football League or the NBA, both in terms of race and national origin. In fact, a significant portion of MLB players are Latin American. Some of them are neighbors from just 90 miles away, Cuban defectors who found asylum in the U.S. by signing with a major league team because they were good enough. That's the sound of center fielder Rusny Castillo, one of Cuba's best players, or at least he was. In late December 2013, Castillo fled his home country. He allegedly made his way to the Dominican Republic in an attempt to sign with an American team.
My understanding is he's somewhere in Latin America securing foreign residency for purposes of avoiding baseball's amateur draft, which imposes limits on the signing bonuses that players can receive.
That's Joe Kioski, a baseball consultant who specializes in Latin American players. He says that nowadays, baseball players like Castillo make their way to Mexico or the Dominican Republic with the help of human traffickers.
These guys are almost always leaving surreptitiously. In the middle of the night, they go to some beach somewhere, and smugglers will put them on a speedboat and spirit them away from the island. They're not just going down to the local boat marina and hopping on a speedboat and leaving during daylight hours.
Castillo is the latest in an ongoing stream of notable defections from Cuba, which comes just months after a recent policy change in Cuba. Its players are now allowed to sign with foreign teams while still retaining their Cuban citizenship. In an interview with ESPN last year, Antonio Castro, son of Fidel Castro, and an advocate for Cuban baseball reform, hinted at this kind of change.
We need to globalize more our sport. We start to work to find more people, who girls and boys who play our sport. Our sport have a power to create excitement, to inspire young people to learn the values of the life.
But the change isn't enough to deter star players like Rusny Castillo from leaving Cuba permanently. In fact, the change isn't likely to sway potential defectors at all.
I don't suspect the changes will do much to slow the defection rate among the young elite players who are potentially worth millions of dollars in Major League Baseball. I expect it will have a big impact on the lower and middle tier players who want to continue playing baseball and don't want to leave their families behind in Cuba. But it probably won't do much to stop Cuba's biggest problem, which is the loss of its most elite players.
What will happen to Rusny Castillo remains to be seen, but there's a good chance the MLB will have a new neighbor from Cuba sitting in the dugout sometime soon. Our next guest knows intimately the reality of defecting from Cuba. Mirta Ojito was born in Cuba and emigrated to Miami in the 1980s during the Mariel boat lift. She's now a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and professor at Columbia University's School of Journalism. Her new book, Hunting Season, tells the story of a murder that took place among neighbors on Long Island in 2008. It's a tale of immigrants, racism, and a hate crime in an all-American town. Mirta Ojito joins us in our studios in Harlem. Mirta, qué chulo verte.
Igualmente, thank you so much.
So, you know, the title, why is this book called Hunting Season?
Because it's a story of an immigrant, Marcelo Lucero, who was killed in Patchogue, Long Island, 5 years ago this week. And Marcelo was killed, attacked and killed by a group of teenagers, seven teenagers, who went around hunting quote-unquote beaners, immigrants, for entertainment. When they were arrested, which was immediately after the crime, one of them, during the confession, said, we didn't do it that often, maybe once or twice a week.
Oh, my God.
And they would drink and do, you know, smoke some weed and then go out attacking immigrants.
What they would say is, we're going to go out and hunt some beaners.
Yeah, yeah.
And interestingly, you know, the term Beaner, again, it's a derogatory term. Of course, Marcelo Lucero was not Mexican. No. He was Ecuadoriano, Ecuadorian.
Absolutely, yeah.
In fact, it gets even a little scarier because in the book you reveal that the immigrants on these towns on Long Island, they also knew that they were being hunted.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, minutes before Marcelo Lucero was attacked, the same group of kids attacked an immigrant who has lived in the United States for more than 30 years, and he is a naturalized U.S. citizen. He's from Colombia. And before that, they had attacked someone else, and the weekend before someone else, and it all came out during the confession and in the trial. The immigrants, of course, knew what was happening, but because many of them were documented, they were very quiet about it. And, you know, eventually, one of them got killed. This had been going on for years.
What made you decide to zero in on this particular story?
There are many ways to answer that question, but one of them is that it was a little too close to home. Patchogue is about 60 miles from us. I have three boys, Latino boys. You know, I just could not. I kept looking at my son at the dinner table. I'm thinking, could he be one of the attackers? Could he be one of the victims? I mean, you start looking at things through the prism of your family and then through the prism of the crime. It was just it was just something so sickening to me. I needed to investigate. I needed to know what it was, what had been going on in that town that could lead to something so horrific, that could make prey of human beings, that could make young people go out and attack people as if they were animals. And I have to make something clear. The crime took place in the village of Patchogue, but in fact, most of them, in fact, none of them lived in the village itself. The village was a place to go hunt these immigrants, but they lived in the towns around it.
In fact, one of the sad things that I actually uncovered in my own reporting around tensions with immigrants in Long Island is that it's the kids learning from their parents. It's not like they just decided this on their own. Somewhere in the family culture, in the community culture, it was okay to attack immigrants, to attack Latino immigrants.
My contention is that these kids were taught from a very early age to dehumanize Latinos. They were taught by what they saw in the media. They were taught by elected officials who, particularly in Suffolk County, were vehemently against undocumented immigrants. And by just the grown-ups in the community. I mean, they grew up in this atmosphere that they're unwanted. We don't want them here. And I have to say, I think with what is going on in the country right now and in Congress, and Congress refusing to come up with a bill that grants citizenship or that allows, not even grants, allows undocumented immigrants to eventually achieve full citizenship. We're not that far from that time.
Tell us about the backgrounds of some of the kids who were implicated and ultimately found guilty in the murder of Marcelo Lucero.
Well, particularly the one who killed Marcelo Lucero, the one who stabbed him, Jeffrey Conroy. You know, he had some academic issues and he had some behavioral issues, but he was definitely a star athlete. And a lot of people looked up to him, and his father had great hopes for him, and he had great hopes for himself. And so this was really devastating for a lot of people. This is Marcelo Lucero, of course, paid with his life, but eight families were completely destroyed with this.
But has there been progress now? Is there a coming together in this part of Long Island that might be hopeful for the rest of the country?
Yes, even as I was reporting the story, because you have to remember this happened 5 years ago. So even as I was reporting the book now, there were signs that things were changing. The most important one, I think, is that the elected officials are now, if they were not before, fully aware of the consequences of their words and their actions. And the mayor, Mayor Pontieri himself, a man who so loves the village that it's hard for him to go on vacation anywhere. He's never been to Calabria, for example, in Italy. He's never been to Italy, where his family's from. Yet he went to Gualaceo in Ecuador, the town from which most of the Ecuadorians in Patchogue come from. So there are signs, there are things. Certainly the library had been doing before and continues to do series of activities. The churches in the area of all denominations. So there's a lot going on in the town. And I see signs that it has changed.
Would you say that what happened with the murder of Marcelo Lucero and the hate crimes against Latinos, is it too extreme to say that this is another form of modern day lynching?
I hesitate to compare crimes like that, but what I can tell you is that hate crimes against Latinos are not new. This is something that has been going on in this country for a very, very long time. But for example, none of the Latino victims of hate crimes have become the Matthew Shepard of Latinos, for example.
Or the Trayvon Martin.
Or the Trayvon Martin, exactly. And there is not one name that has risen to that level. Why? I don't know. But I was shocked to see the number of Latinos who have been killed in recent years and also historically everywhere in the United States. I mean, we tend to think maybe Texas, but certainly Texas, but Florida, New York, pretty much everywhere.
So is it true, though, that the numbers, because we did a little bit of research and it looks like the anti-Latino hate crimes since, let's say, a high in 2008, that there's actually been a something of a decrease now. Have you been able to gauge if, in fact, the hate crimes against Latinos are taking a downward trend now?
I haven't, because I focused my research on what was happening up to the time that Marcelo Lucero was killed. I do know that immediately after he was killed, the numbers went up 30%, but that could be a function of people feeling more emboldened to report crimes that they had not been reporting before. The rhetoric against Latinos has also changed somewhat.
A little bit.
A little. Well, we have places like California doing things that are really interesting for immigrants. We have the president of the University of California offering $5 million to attract undocumented students. The reversal of the law in Alabama. De Blasio saying, we're going to get them IDs. I mean, there are things going on. When I was reporting this book, states were taking the initiative to control, to drive away. I feel that now states are beginning to take an initiative as well, because the federal government's still not doing anything, but a different kind of initiative. Now some of them are saying, you know what? Stay here or come here. We want you. We cannot give you citizenship, but maybe we can help you get you a driver's license. Maybe you can go to college with in-state tuition. I mean, there are things happening that certainly were not happening 10, 15 years ago.
Mirita Ojito, thank you so much for all of your work in journalism and for writing this very powerful book. We really thank you for joining us on Latino USA.
Gracias, Maria.
Mirita Ojito is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the new book, Hunting Season, Immigration and Murder in an All-American Town. In New York City, or Chicago, or L.A., the word neighborhood is often followed by the word gentrification. But it's an issue in smaller cities, too. So when producer Angus Anderson bought a home in one of Tucson's oldest Hispanic neighborhoods, it left him with the sinking feeling that he had become a gentrifier. But he decided to be conscientious and go out and meet his neighbors and get to know them like a good neighbor. Here's his story.
This train is the grandchild of the Southern Pacific locomotive that sliced Tucson in half in 1880. Once, the town was integrated, but as it grew, Hispanics increasingly settled on the west and south sides, Anglos on the north and east. Recently, I bought a century-old pile of lava rocks and termites in Menlo Park, a neighborhood in the middle of the west side. The Menlo Park area started out as a Native American settlement. Then whites moved in, and for the last 100 years, it's been Hispanic. It's one of the few neighborhoods in Tucson where families go back more than a generation.
My name's Angus. I'm a radio producer.
Uh-huh.
And I just moved into Menlo Park, and I'm doing a story on Menlo Park in Barrio Hollywood.
My husband's actually the one that grew up in the neighborhood. He lives a block down. His family has been here for 30, 35 years.
It's a bright day in Menlo Park, the park the neighborhood is named after. Sylvia Amparano stands next to a picnic table surrounded by a throng of children in red soccer jerseys.
There's a lot of elderly, too. My husband's grandparents have lived in the neighborhood for ever.
That's great.
But there are newcomers, too. Gene Einfrank has been here only 7 years, but he's become president of the Menlo Park Neighborhood Association. He lives in a new development around the Mercado San Agustin, a building designed to resemble a colonial Spanish market.
If you walk around the Mercado district, you see in the architecture a look back into Tucson's history.
The Mercado is also the end of a streetcar line that will cross the old railroad tracks, connecting Menlo Park to gentrifying areas around downtown and the University of Arizona. That's where I met Lydia Otero, a lifelong Tucsonan and historian.
The streetcar is going to appeal to a lot of people. They're going to want to move to Menlo Park. I personally have had conversations with people in Barrio Hollywood, and they have no reservations about calling people gentrifiers.
Barrio Hollywood is Menlo Park's sister neighborhood to the north. It was a locus of Chicano activism in the 70s. When people there picture gentrifiers, I have a feeling they see me.
All the properties I've sold downtown and all the smaller barrios have all been, I can't think of anybody of color.
Demographic and economic shifts aren't new, but in talking to my neighbors, I see they mean different things to different people. For Sylvia Amparano, it can be a good thing.
I don't think it's a negative. I don't see it as a negative. I think it's taking us to the next level, I guess.
Geraldo Parra is lighting a grill in his backyard. I ask him if he's worried about affluent whites overrunning his neighborhood. He's not. He himself might have been a gentrifier when he moved here 20 years ago.
But you know what? There's a lot of Mexican people that have money also. So it's not a white thing, you know. You know, if you want it, you will have it.
Do you want a little more horchata?
I think I'm good. Solomon Baldenegro doesn't seem worried about me either. He's a longtime neighborhood activist from Tucson's west side. As he presides over a plate of enchiladas, he tells me the real threat of gentrification comes from political elites bent on weakening neighborhood identity and unity.
There's a move afoot to dilute our political clout. And one of the ways to do it is to disperse us.
Solomon tells me about the city of Tucson's recent attempt to replace a municipal golf course with a for-profit university. For him, the golf course is symbolic. It's where he and other neighborhood activists pressured the city to carve a park and community center out of a predominantly white country club. Hispanics in Barrio Hollywood and Menlo Park have been a force in city politics ever since. The golf course deal has collapsed, but Solomon still thinks the city is trying to gentrify longtime residents out of Barrio Hollywood.
Well, you can disperse it because you'll still have 10,000 Mexican-American Democrats, but 5 here, 10 there, 100 there, they have no power.
Other people in Barrio Hollywood and Menlo Park favor the redevelopment project. It's a reminder that reactions to development and displacement can vary significantly, even within a small community. Back in the immaculate newness of the Mercado, Gene Einfrank and I sit across the street from old homes in various states of disrepair.
How do you keep people who are there from not getting driven out? You know, are we kind of prisoners of a much bigger system? I mean,
I think we are, and that's perhaps the unfortunate aspect. That's really hard to get around.
Neither of us wants to be a gentrifier. But larger economic and political pressures may shape Menlo Park's future more than we will, despite our best intentions.
That was Angus Anderson from Tucson. Coming up, a kind of queasy story about the neighbors that are with us all the time.
You're born 100% human, and then you die 10% human and 90% microbe.
Those neighborly microbes on Latino USA. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now a story about neighbors from the land of Oz, or rather, Kansas. Out there on the dusty plains in the middle of the American heartland is a small town that has made neighbors of people from all over the world. Garden City, Kansas, once a very white town, is now home to Mexicans, Central Americans, Asians, and Africans. They came for the jobs, thousands of them in the huge meatpacking plants that turned cattle into beef. Now, an area once known as a cowboy capital has become a cultural crossroads. Peggy Lowe reports.
Garden City's Main Street could be a movie set for Middle America with its pretty line of well-tended homes and storefronts. But look a little closer and you'll be surprised. There are Mexican and Vietnamese restaurants. And down the road, across from the community college, is a refugee center where 20-year-old Twahida works.
Assistant Opportunity Center, this is Twahida. How may I help you?
Twahida is Burmese. She was born in a refugee camp in Thailand and came with her parents about 5 years ago so they could work at the Tyson beef packing plant here. She's the first person in her family to go to college, and her father hopes he's the last person in the family to kill, cut, and box up cattle carcasses at the slaughterhouse.
He told me that, like, he have to work there because he have no education. So he want me to get my education and become a successful person and be helpful in family.
Twahida is the newest incarnation in an age-old American story, immigrants coming here in hopes of a better life. In the last 30 years, they've doubled Garden City's population to 30,000. Half the people are Latino, while just 40% are white. Immigration has transformed many Midwestern towns, but Garden City's reaction was unique.
They didn't have any exemplars that they could look to how do we do this, how do we do that. You know, they sort of built the airplane while they were in the air, and they built a pretty good plane.
That's Don Stull, a University of Kansas anthropologist who has recorded Garden City's progress since the first meatpacking plant was built here in 1980. The earliest newcomers were the Vietnamese after the fall of Saigon. Lavita Rollman, a former Catholic nun who met them, says the town was overwhelmed.
It got so bad, housing-wise, that people were sleeping at the riverbed. It was dry, but they were sleeping in the riverbed with their blankets and their pillows and their tents.
Local pastors, watching people seek food and shelter, rallied the faith community, Rollman says. She remembers the local Presbyterian preacher quoting scripture.
It came down to him imploring us to reflect upon what our vision was. And the vision was, we have these people here. Are we going to accept them as a blessing? Are we going to consider them a curse?
They chose blessing. The people of Garden City met their new global citizens with a host of services. They opened food banks and shelters, offered English classes and job help. After the Vietnamese came Mexicans. Then came Central Americans. Now there's a surge of Somali and Burmese refugees. Three quarters of the students in the local school district are minorities, hailing from more than a dozen countries.
You know, we talk about what can we do to help them. And what do we need to know about them, too? We learn from them, they learn from us, and I just think that that's what makes our community a lot better.
Janie Perkins was once one of those children. Born Juana Vargas in Mexico, she came to Garden City when she was 11 so her father could work in the meatpacking plant. Perkins got a college education, became a teacher, and ultimately became the first Latina mayor of Garden City and a University of Kansas regent. She now works for the school district.
We all come together to help. And, you know, I'm a product of that. I truly am. And I think that's why I love what I do. To me, it's a way of giving back for what was given to me.
If Garden City's decision to welcome the immigrants working in the meatpacking plants is benevolent, it's also good for business.
So I guess we can just pull right over here.
Don Stull is parked outside a high chain link fence that surrounds an old ConAgra plant. A suspicious fire gutted it on Christmas Eve 2000.
It was supposedly spontaneous combustion.
When this plant shuttered, the town lost 2,300 jobs and tax revenues. City leaders learned how dependent their fortunes were on the beef business and the immigrants who work in it.
We lost our swagger. You know, so Garden City had weathered all of these other economic problems that had beset agriculture in the 80s, and they were growing, they were beacon on the plains, and then all of a sudden
Since then, the town has slowly recovered. Back at the refugee center, some Somali parents come in for help with filling out school forms for their children. Although people of different ethnicities work together at the plant, they mostly stick to their own groups. And since Tyson has been recently recruiting refugees who are in the U.S. legally, there has been a little resentment from undocumented workers, mostly Mexicans and Central Americans. Velia Mendoza understands. She's the director of the refugee center. She came here as a child from Mexico, like many of the people she knows.
And I tell you that because one of the things they tell me is, you know, Miss Velia, you're Hispanic. Why are you helping these people? Well, number one is my job. Number two, we at one time needed that help too. So now I'm able to give it back.
For most people in Garden City, it's a source of pride to have so many colorful neighbors. They point to the winning soccer club or that their kids are growing up with best friends from the other side of the world. That spirit matches the city's logo, a yucca with a rainbow of colors, along with its motto, "The world grows here." For Latino USA, I'm Peggy Lowe, reporting from Garden City, Kansas.
So when I first visited Garden City, Kansas, almost 20 years ago, I remember thinking how incredible it was. Deep diversity and acceptance in the heart of Middle America. It felt like what was happening in Garden City was the very best traits of America coming forward. Tolerance, diversity, acceptance, and neighborliness. Now, as we continue to look into the story behind this melting pot on the prairie, we're joined by former Garden City Mayor Tim Cruz. Cruz was born and raised in Garden City in a Mexican-American family. He served as mayor from 1995 to 2002 and now sits on the local school board. Welcome to Latino USA, Mr. Mayor.
Hello.
So a lot of people think of Kansas and they don't necessarily think about diversity. But in fact, Garden City has really become a success story for how many different kinds of people can live together. So what do you think the recipe for that success has been?
I think the leaders in our community, in our school district, in our colleges, they made decisions based on newcomers coming to Garden City that we needed to do all we can to make them welcome. And they did an outstanding job, I think. And instead of saying, you know, we're going to have a problem with all these people coming in Garden City that don't speak English, they embraced it, tried to figure out how we can help them develop into good, productive people in our community. And it's really been a great blessing for us.
We've just heard that 77% of the school district is non-white. So what does it actually mean and look like when you have this kind of demographic in your schools?
When we were growing up, there was probably a handful of Hispanic kids in our classroom. So, and as you go into school today and you look around and all you see is all these brown faces, it's like, wow, man, that is pretty cool. My wife's a school teacher, and last year in their school, one of the kids that won the spelling bee, he had only been in her school for, I think, this is a year and a half now. When he came to Garden City, he knew no English, and he won his classroom spelling bee. And I thought, man, now that's pretty darn amazing. So very, very exciting for me growing up in Hispanic and seeing the leadership and the opportunities that our young kids are having.
So the theme of our show on Latino USA this week is neighbors. And in a town like Garden City, essentially, people actually know and interact with their neighbors in a way that, you know, maybe we might not do it in a big city like New York.
In our block that we live in, we have Hispanics, we have Anglo people, our newest neighbors are Southeast Asian. I mean, they bring over egg rolls and we take over burritos, and we don't see... Well, that's a Southeast Asian neighbor, and, you know, that's not part of our culture. We shouldn't have anything to do with it. We just do just the opposite. We say we need to embrace them. They're our neighbors, and, you know, let's be friends. And that's my neighborhood, but almost any neighborhood you go in Garden City, I can tell you that message is probably about the same. We just want to be good friends. We want to be good neighbors, and the way you do that is open up your arms.
Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Former Mayor Tim Cruz now sits on the school board in Garden City, Kansas, and he also teaches the town's driver safety course. And now to the neighbors that live inside of us, in our gut. Scientists are just beginning to understand how the bacteria we carry in our guts can affect our vulnerability to diseases. Science writer Moises Velázquez-Manoff joins us to talk about this. Welcome back to Latino USA, Moises.
Hi, it's great to be back.
So, to be honest with you, I have spent most of my life trying to get rid of things in my gut. And now, basically, we're saying, no, we've got to look at this bacteria, find it, and treat it like a good neighbor.
That's right. I mean, we basically, as a civilization, have spent the last 150 years or so trying to get rid of bacteria. And what's happened in the last, say, 10 years is that we've realized there are certain bacteria that we actually need for our health. And so the question is, how do we actually cultivate those bacteria while still excluding the nasty ones, because they're not necessarily the same bacteria?
How much of this friendly bacteria do we actually have as our good neighbors inside of us? And what do they do?
Well, they do a lot. They outnumber our cells by 10 to 1, and that's mostly because they're much smaller than our cells.
Okay, wait, I got to stop you right there. Wait a second. So that means basically we're like 90% microbes?
That's exactly. There's a saying that's going around that you're born 100% human and then you die 10% human and 90% microbe, because when you're born, you're, at least in theory, sterile, and then you're colonized by all these microbes as soon as you enter the world.
So they're good for us?
They're very good for us. They synthesize vitamins for us. They help us digest food. What they're now discovering is that they kind of act like a defensive line, if you will, in our gut, which is one of our areas where we get invaded most often.
There is a conversation, though, among scientists about finding ancestral bacteria. So what does that mean?
The idea is, first of all, westernized populations, modern populations, are mostly urban. We eat a very different kind of diet than we used to eat. And it seems that we have a very different community of microbes. And the way to get to your question, the way they understand this is by comparing our microbes with people who live much more traditional lifestyles in, say, the Amazon jungle or in rural Africa. The difference is that immediately jumps out at you is that there's a loss of diversity in our microbes. And so the question immediately is, does some of that loss of diversity lead to some of the Western diseases? Because there's this very sort of this dichotomy of diseases that you see immediately where we're much more prone to, say, colon cancer or asthma or allergies or autoimmune diseases than people living in those environments. People living in those environments are much more prone to infectious disease. What you want to do is exclude all the pathogens that kill you, but still allow through or figure out what the health-promoting bacteria are, so that we can actually replace some of them that we've presumably lost.
So if I want to find out all my good neighborly bacteria, should I actually do this? And is there a way to find out?
Well, there is actually this project called the American Gut Project. It's a crowdsourced project.
No, you're kidding me. The American Gut Project?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. It's and so you basically send in samples and you send in a little money, and they tell you what kind of bacteria you harbor. And then they use the data for a much larger project. It's just a curiosity item at this point. It doesn't really tell you much, but you can do it if you like.
So oftentimes, Moises, you know, with neighbors, it's like you don't understand your neighbor. You don't really know what your neighbor is doing. So is that part of this conversation, which is don't be upset about your neighbors inside of your gut. Learn to get to know them a little bit better.
Yeah. And also, the germ theory of disease is a major revolution in our understanding of how to cure ourselves from disease. And that is that, you know, microbes cause disease, get rid of the microbe, you get rid of the disease. We've approached all microbes with that attitude. So it turns out you can't not have microbes in this world. Those are our neighbors. They're on us, they're in us. So it's more a question of keeping the right neighbors present that keep you healthy, rather than getting rid of all neighbors. And it's a very different kind of attitude.
Moises, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thanks for having me.
Moises Velázquez-Manoff is a science writer who joins us frequently to talk about science on Latino USA. We're continuing our collaboration with the magazine Culture Strike to bring you another poetry edition of Sabiduría, Words of Wisdom from Poets. This week, we're speaking to award-winning poet and performance artist Tim Hernandez about growing up in rural California and the power that language had over him as a child.
You know, as a young child growing up in the San Joaquin Valley, the family of migrant farm workers, language is, you know, becomes a sort of very sort of pragmatic, you know, usage. We don't think of it in terms of creative or expressive in any way necessarily in the beginning, right? You know, I think one of the most powerful memories I have in terms of language is one time when I was living in the town of Dinuba there in Tulare County in California, and the woman my grandparents lived across from was this white woman who basically would always tell myself and my cousins, you know, go back to Mexico, go back where you're from, and which was startling to me because I was born in that town that she was yelling at me, you know. I said, what do you mean go back? I'm here. This is where I'm from. But, you know, I was a kid. I didn't know how to respond to that, and I also felt the sort of power of that as well. But fortunately for me, my parents were very sort of language-oriented people. You know, my father often sort of told jokes and also told spun stories. My mother read to us quite a bit. So there was a lot of wordplay in my home growing up. So, you know, pretty quickly on, I learned the power of language and also that it belonged to me. For myself, though, starting out as a visual artist, my trajectory included a very close uncle of mine who I grew up with pretty much and who was killed in a very tragic way. And after that happened, I felt like painting wasn't urgent enough. You know, I had things I wanted to say. I had ideas on my mind and opinions. And I felt the fastest and most urgent medium was writing it and speaking it. You know, for me, though, it wasn't until years after my first book, a few years after that, someone sort of pointed out to me how image-driven my poetry is. And I suddenly realized that there were these sort of correlations between the way I was describing certain things in my poetry. And I would look at them and I'd realize, oh, that was like the painting I did, you know, 5 years ago. It looks like the painting. I was trying to describe the painting. So for me, language now is the palette that I draw from.
You can hear Tim Hernandez reading a selection of his poems on our website at latinousa.org. Special thanks to Eduardo Corral of Culture Strike for curating our poet series. That's it for this week, but first I want to acknowledge some exciting news. We have a new time slot on WNYC in our hometown of New York City. We're on Sunday nights now at 7 p.m. on AM 820, and we're so excited. So if you're listening in the Big Apple, give us a shout out on Twitter. Latino USA was produced this week by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, Jonathan Wolf, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Antonia Cerejido. And Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa, from our studios in Harlem. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Perhaps it was just a piece of hard candy.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring, with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.